Hi guys, this is going to be a relatively brief video, and I'm not going to get into all of the detail about the book that I'm going to show you, but I want to say one or two things about it in case it piques your interest and in case there's something here that resonates. The book is called Understanding Computers and Cognition, A New Foundation for Design, written by Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores. This book came out in the 80s, and it's about... You could say it's about Heidegger and AI. Okay, that would be one way of seeing it. The way they put it, it's a book about the design of computer technology. In it, we look closely at computers as they exist today, and we set out new directions for future development. But they do it with an eye to the background of a tacit understanding of human nature and human work. And Heidegger is the thinker above all. Not only, they also mention Gadamer, they also mention somebody else, but Heidegger is the thinker who, above all, guides their thinking in this topic of a background of tacit understanding of human nature and human work. So I want to put it to you like this briefly. The first part of the book discusses the rationalistic philosophic tradition, which sees, let's say, the primary realm of truth as being propositional statements and judgments about states of affairs, as sentences about the world as it is, and the assumption that they challenge, I think, assumption that, although they state it in the 80s, may be relevant to how you think about large language models today. The rationalistic assumption is that you can capture the totality of human knowledge propositionally. And that's from what they say. Those of you who are in this industry know better than I do. I'm taking their word for it to some extent. That's the somehow guiding hypothesis or guiding approach to the design of computer systems, and in particular to the design of artificial intelligence systems. Now, again, this was written in the 80s, and there's some time to take into account since then. All the more so with the recent explosion of these new kinds of models, transformers and all the rest of it. And what they argue, the key point I would say that they argue, the key thing that we learn from Heidegger, is that the human being as throne, a technical term in Heidegger's philosophy, but you can just sort of understand it. I'm going to give you an example here from their book, always has a background way of being in the world, a background non-formulizable, you know, non-enclosable set of considerations and set of familiarities and possibilities within which, you could say, knowingly or unknowingly, the designer of computer programs selects a sort of starting point. Okay, so I'm going to say that again, then I'm going to give you a couple of examples. I mean, I'm trying to just paraphrase this in a way that's more or less understandable without you having to read, you know, the 200-page book and instead get it in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. Let's use a brief example, okay? I'm not going to read it to you. I'm just going to say it from memory. If your friend comes over and he asks you, hey, you have any water in the fridge? You say, yeah, man, go for it. He opens the fridge and there's no water there. What does that mean? It means there's no bottle of water. There's no jug of water. There's no drinkable water. You know, and he could come back to you and say, yeah, you know, there's water. There's condensation. That probably would frustrate you and annoy you and be like, what are you doing? Why are you playing? You know, obviously, what I meant when I asked whether there's water in the fridge is there drinkable water in the fridge? Now, the condensation is water. Okay, but they're point in a way is that the language that we use, it doesn't just have this sort of neutral referent. It depends in part on our purposes. For the purpose of slaking my thirst, I'm requesting whether there's drinkable water in proper form, like a bottle or a jug. But you know, if I had other purposes, if I was checking for condensation, then you'd use a different definition of water when I asked whether there's water in the fridge. Okay, so if the rationalistic tradition loosely tries to associate a strict meaning to a term, the broader Heideggerian interpretation, again, loosely speaking, it takes into account the fact that we have concerns, purposes, intentions, and that the meaning of words differs, and so too does the design of programs. So the authors are very keen to tell us that these programs are made, and the interests of the makers get baked in. And the AI cannot know or understand in the way that a human being can know or understand, because when a human being understands, he understands against this backdrop. But when an AI operates, it doesn't operate against that backdrop. So they find Heidegger to be useful in discussing that. And, you know, I would say if we fast forward 40 or so years, you know, not quite, I think this was written, whatever, 86 or 87, doesn't matter. But if we say roughly we go to today's large language models, well, you know, there's a dispute and a debate about the politics of those models. You know, that they've been trained not only on a certain set of data, but that they've also been tuned, or they've also been directed. They've also been instructed. There are certain questions they won't answer, certain topics they won't broach, certain things that they're not allowed to do or to say. Well, where did they get those guidelines? Where did they get those guardrails? From the concerns of their programmers, and those concerns may vary. So that's, again, one of the key points. Don't get misled by the rhetoric of AI human-like understanding, but rather actually grasp that computer programs serve a very important function as, for example, communication tools between human beings, and they can be programmed in a way and designed in a way that helps the human being to fulfill on his interests in the world. Okay, so I'll mention another thing from the book. Maybe this will be 10 to 15 minutes, but you can skip ahead or 2x speed or whatever helps you with your specific interests at the moment. Okay, but another notion in the book is the notion of the philosopher Austin about speech as speech acts, where you don't just have propositions where you're concerned with their truth or falsity. You also have acts like, you also have speech acts like, you know, when you are pronounced man and wife. That's like brought a new state of affairs into existence. You know, there's now something that exists in language. Okay, so agreements, requests, commitments, these are all acts that we undertake in language. And so the analysis of language as a human concern in which we take action, what kind of action, as I said, making a request, making a commitment, and so on. Something that they analyze, incidentally, not only in this book with respect to how computers can be useful in that. So for example, you know, they said, you can program, and you should program, you're familiar enough with this now, you know, a reminder, my calendar, I can schedule a reminder, because one sort of speech act is to be reminded. That's not a true or false thing. It's I'm something that's helpful for me in my life, not necessarily something that falls within a rationalistic model. Okay, so speech act. This author, Fernando Flores, Chilean, who was a high-ranking member of the government in Chile at one point, I think was a political prisoner there as well, he's interesting in his own way as somebody who has taken the reception of Heidegger, not only in this book but in other books, and driven it into the fields of management and personal transformation and coaching and things like that. The reason I mention that is he also has a book called Conversations for Action, a part of which is discussed in this book under the speech acts model. Let me just show you super quickly so this doesn't go on too long. There's, even though the book Conversations for Actions goes into quite a lot of detail, here it's formalized. I'll put this on screen. I don't know whether you can see it. It's really just sort of mapping out a conversation with an eye to the action possibilities in it. So there's a request or a promise, you know, it can be rejected, withdrawn, it can be countered, it can be fulfilled, the conditions of fulfillment can be, you know, assessed, and all of that until the people who are in that conversation are satisfied with the outcome. Okay, so a basic conversation for action. Last thing I want to say about Flores before I make one or two more comments about the book, he also has a nice book called Disclosing New Worlds, where Hubert Dreyfus, you may know, another Heideggerian who had an interest in computer technology, he's an author there in that book as well, Disclosing New Worlds, and it's on entrepreneurship, on solidarity. Another fascinating reception of Heidegger into a completely different direction than the one you may be used to hearing me talk about when I talk about Strauss and the other political philosophers and political theorists who read Heidegger. Okay, but I want to give you another example from the book. This is about using computers for sort of problem solving and decision making. So you may know decision is an important term in Heidegger's philosophy. In fact, I was just teaching it today in its highly philosophical sense, which he mentions in the Contributions to Philosophy. But here we're going to bring it down to a very ordinary situation, okay, an extremely ordinary situation. And this example is designed to show that there's always more at stake in some sense than can be programmed in, kind of like the water example. And the, again, why does it matter? Because this more at stake, or this extra residue, or this background field of concerns and all of that, it goes to show you the limitations of what can be programmed, the limitations of what can be expected from computation. So one word of context here, okay? There's a notion in Being and Time, you may remember, you may have heard about, of a breakdown, okay? A breakdown. All kinds of breakdowns that Heidegger mentions. For example, something can no longer work. So here I have a cigar, okay? Here you go, cigar. Cigar lighter. My cigar went out. Okay, I want to relight it. Now, imagine I try to do so, no flame, okay? Right on cue. That wasn't supposed to happen, but I'm glad that it did happen. So that would be a breakdown, you know, an object in my world, an item or a utensil or a useful thing in my world that I'm expecting to function in a certain way doesn't do so, okay? That's one possible breakdown is something doesn't work. His example in Being in Time, you know, the hammer. The hammer doesn't exist for you as a quote-unquote object. It exists for you as a useful tool, as the thing that you need because, you know, you got to put up the painting that your wife bought at a garage sale or whatever the case is, right? It's something that's in your environment that you use as a tool. It doesn't exist for you as an abstract object. It exists for you as a useful tool. But it can appear to you no longer as a useful tool when you experience a breakdown. Okay, again, one breakdown could be it's not functioning. This is now just talking about tools, not even about our own purposes or projects, although they're related, obviously. Another one could be it's missing. Okay, I wanted to light the cigar. I go to find the lighter, and it's not there. It's conspicuously absent. Okay, before it was just there for me to work with, and then suddenly it's conspicuously absent. There's a breakdown in my world of useful things related to my to what I'm doing. So what am I doing? Enjoying a cigar. What's the breakdown? In this example, the lighter is broken or the lighter is missing. And for Heidegger, that's part of the important shift towards how we're just sort of embedded in a work world, let's say, or a world of things that we take care of. And we begin to abstract sort of from the use. And he discusses at length in Being in Time, the transformation of the useful thing into sort of, as it were, the mere thing or the objective thing, the objective presence, okay? We don't need to get into all of that, but what's crucial is the notion of a breakdown. Okay, so they incorporate the notion of a breakdown and thinking about what a computer could be useful for, what a program could be useful for. I'm going to give you now one, I'm going to zero in on one section. So they say the question, what needs to be done, arises in a breakdown in which the course of activity is interrupted by some kind of unreadiness, okay? That makes sense. I think we just set it up, right? To repeat, a breakdown where the course of activity is interrupted by some kind of unreadiness. If my activity was smoking the cigar, the lighter doesn't work, the lighter's not there, that's an unreadiness. It is often manifested in hesitation and confusion. Okay, so maybe this is like you're not sure what you're going to do. Something's no longer obvious. You're rolling through the day in a sort of obvious way. And now it's like, well, wait a minute. What am I going to do? Should I not smoke the cigar? Should I go find another lighter? Again, using a trivial example here to make the point. It is often manifested in hesitation and confusion, and now we get to an important point, is always already oriented to a certain direction of possibilities. This pre-orientation of possibilities appears as an exclusionary bias. revealing a space of possible actions and simultaneously concealing others. So what possible action do I see with my always already being oriented to certain direction of possibilities, this pre-orientation? What possibility do I see? Not having the cigar, that's one. Going to the miscellaneous drawer and trying to find another lighter, that's another. Okay, that's two, probably the two most obvious ones. Either don't have it or find a lighter. And what's not coming to mind immediately, once upon a time in my life, maybe, you know, lighting it on a gas stove. No, that didn't come to mind. Okay, trying to get a spark with two rocks or two stones. That didn't come to mind, right? Those did not show up as possible actions. They were concealed by a pre-orientation, okay? Now we have their example. We move away from my example. You have been commuting to work in your old Chevrolet. Recently, you have had to jumpstart it three times, and there has been an ominous scraping sound every time you apply the brakes. One morning, as you're driving to work, you cannot get it into first gear. You take it to a mechanic who says there's a major problem with the transmission. Clearly, you are in a situation of irresolution. Okay, you don't necessarily know what to do, right? You're facing a problem. Okay, you're facing a problem. A mechanic has told you there's a major issue with the transmission. You talk to your husband and decide that there are several alternatives. You can have the old car repaired, or you can buy a used or a new car. If you want a used car, you can try to get it through friends or newspaper ads, or you can go to a dealer. Okay, you've got a sort of decision tree here, right? If you get a new one, you maybe want a van you can use for camping trips, but you're not sure you can afford it and still go on the vacation you'd planned. In fact, you're not sure if you can afford a new car at all, since you have to keep up the payments and insurance on your husband's car as well. Here's the example, now here's the analysis. From the point of view of classical decision theory, the task is to lay out the space of alternatives and to assign valuations to each. This includes dealing with the uncertainties, such as not knowing how much the repair will cost, right? That's an uncertainty. How much trouble it will be to find a used car, and what your financial situation will be in the future. In addition, it requires comparing factors that are not directly comparable. How important is it to be able to go camping in comfort? How bad is it to be stuck with car payments that make the budget a hassle every month? What would it mean to give up the vacation? How valuable is it to avoid the increased worry about the breakdowns that come with a used car? How do you feel about being seen driving an old clunker? Okay, so we've got a problem. We have what it looks like from the point of view of classical decision theory. But the problem is not just that it is impossible to apply systematic decision techniques, but that there is a bias inherent in formulating the situation as one of choosing between these alternatives. Imagine that on the next day, since you can't drive to work, you call and check the city buses and find one you can take. After a few days of taking the bus, you realize you didn't really need the car. The problem of how can I get a working car has not been solved. It has been dissolved. Okay? Dissolved. You realize that the problem you really wanted to solve was how can I get to work? Of course, one might argue that you failed to identify the real space of alternatives, but that it existed nevertheless. Like, okay, if only we had looked harder, we would have been able to delineate the real space of alternatives. But now the authors continue, imagine a slightly different scenario. The bus ride takes too long, and you're complaining about the situation to your friend at work. He commiserates with you since his bicycling to work is unpleasant when it rains. The two of you come up with the idea of having the company buy a van for an employee carpool. In this case, resolution comes in the creation of a new alternative. The issue is not one of choosing, but of generating. Or on the other hand, you might steal a car or set up housekeeping in a tent in your office or commit suicide. God forbid. Each in its own way would quote unquote solve the problem. We are seriously misled if we consider the relevant space of alternatives to be the space of all logical possibilities, and then somehow hear the clincher. Relevance always comes from a pre-orientation within a background. Okay, they continue on with the example a little bit. I'm not going to read it through to you, but it's this crucial factor of a pre-orientation, a fathomless background of obviousness, which does not get articulated. Okay, that's their phrase, the fathomless background of obviousness. And it's very important for them to see that this cannot be programmed and that this does not fall under the rubric of problem solving, because again, the problem can be dissolved. So you have something arising in a breakdown. Okay, the car wasn't working, couldn't light the cigar. Maybe I give up smoking on the spot. Okay, maybe I take it as a sign from God. So that can't really be mapped out, is their point. It doesn't fall into a decisionistic tree that can be sort of exhausted. And it can't, because kind of like, if you'll permit me here before we stop the video, an image from mathematics that I like is Cantor's diagonalization theory, right? So feel free to tune this out, or feel free to look it up, or whatever else you want to do with it. Cantor's diagonalization theorem, basically an idea, you know, which says, and he's not the only person who makes an argument like this that you can apply to thinking about philosophy and Heidegger and what can be bounded and not bounded. But in short, you know, imagine every possibility being on a list. Okay. Imagine you said, yeah, there's a, even if there's an infinite amount of possibilities, can they be listed so that each possibility can be mapped to one of the natural numbers? So like possibility 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, dot, 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 and whatever, right? Infinite number of possibilities listed. Cantor, you should watch, take 5 minutes and watch a YouTube video on Cantor's diagonalization theorem. The assumption that you can have an exhaustive list, I'm not going into the details, okay, of like infinite sets and so on, but for our purposes, imagine you could list out the possibilities, imagine that they're infinite. He showed that you can always generate from within the given list one more possibility that wasn't on the list. Okay, that's the proof. I'm giving you the impression of the proof, okay? A mathematical proof that concerning certain infinite sets, you assume that you can list them, but then you demonstrate that there was one possibility that wasn't on the list. Couldn't have been, okay? It gets constructed deliberately across the diagonal. And if you add that possibility to the list, you can prove that there's another possibility that wasn't on it. So this inability to capture, to enclose, to present, to finalize, to formulate, to complete, that inability, that reminds one, reminds me, of this idea of a background, of that fathomless abyss of possibilities that can't be put into a decisionistic tree. Okay, so understanding computers and cognition, again, relying mostly but not solely on Heidegger, demonstrating that computers can be very useful tools indeed. Don't think you needed a proof of that. But humbling us in our claim that they can be autonomous intelligences that understand. And the way to introduce that humility is to really grasp what it means for a human being to understand. Is there water in the fridge? Okay. What are my options? So I think that's nice for now. You can read the book if you want. And take an interest. Okay. Fernando Flores, in general, I've said this before in other contexts, I'll say it again for those of you who are still listening or watching, that if you think about the reception of Heidegger, okay, he's been influential all over the place, not only in political philosophy, not only in political theory, and not only in problems of artificial intelligence and computers. He's been immensely influential across all fields of sciences and the arts and everything else you can imagine. But one kind of distinctly interesting field for me personally is Fernando Flores, the life coaching slash management slash entrepreneurship reception, and a person who is related to Flores. And I think I once read that Flores is the person who introduced this other person to Heidegger, but I don't know about that. I don't know about that for sure. Is Werner Erhard. There's a nice book I've mentioned called Speaking Being, which describes the way that Heidegger's philosophy was incorporated into the seminars of Werner Erhard, who had a company called Est and then Landmark Worldwide, and then he does something else now, and applied Heidegger's insights into personal transformation, business transformation, coaching, executive coaching, and all that. Weird, fascinating, interesting, and good, in my opinion, okay? So there you go. Understanding computers and cognition, just enough to whet your appetite. Obviously, we went way longer than I intended, but I hope you find this to be a nice addition to your membership in the Millerman School and just a nice contribution to your intellectual interests. Okay, guys, thank you. Take care.